Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we'll hear from a merchant marine and meet Minnesota's Secretary of State, Steve Simon. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
Gold Star Mother's Day is a day for people to recognize and honor those who have lost a son or a daughter while serving the United States Armed Forces. The name, Gold Star Mothers, was derived from the custom of military families who put a service flag near their front window. The flag featured a star for each family member serving their country. Living members were denoted in blue, while gold stars honored family members who were killed while on duty. American Gold Star Mothers Incorporated began with 25 mothers living in the Washington, D.C. area in 1929, and it soon expanded to include affiliated groups throughout the nation. Chapters even sprang up in Minnesota, but over the years, membership dwindled and the chapters became inactive. As deployments rose after 9/11, and we engaged in operations Enduring Freedom, Iraqi Freedom, and New Dawn, the need for a new Gold Star Mother chapter in Minnesota also rose. Led by Gold Star Mother Barbara Farrell, a group of Minnesota Gold Star Mothers went to work to support each other and start a new Gold Star Mothers chapter. On October 1st, 2009, the charter for the Gold Star Mother chapter for Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota was granted. Today, our thoughts and prayers go out to those mothers who've lost a child while serving in the United States Armed Forces. Our thoughts are also with the nearly 500 Gold Star family members right here in Minnesota.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. The United States Merchant Marine is the fleet of U.S. civilian-owned merchant vessels operated by either the government or the private sector that engage in commerce or transportation of goods and services in and out of navigable waters of the United States. In time of war, the Merchant Marine is capable of being an auxiliary to the Navy and can be called upon to deliver military personnel and materials for the military. The Merchant Marine operate and maintain deep-sea merchant ships, tugboats, towboats, ferries, dredges, excursion vessels, and other waterborne craft on the oceans, the Great Lakes, rivers, canals, harbors, and other waterways. As of 2006, the United States merchant fleet numbered 465 ships and approximately 100,000 members. Joining me on this segment today is Marsh Gabriel, who served in the United States Navy during World War II and became a merchant marine right afterwards. Marsh, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Wow, thanks. Happy to be here.
Marsh, can you tell me when did you enlist? How did you get in the Navy?
Back up a little bit. As a boy, I loved to sea. I lived, born and raised on the Hare River, had a boat, read books about the sea and so forth, and I wanted to be in a sailing on cargo ship, merchant marine. But when the war came along, Pearl Harbor was my 20th birthday, and I was on a fishing trip with my family, and we found out that way. Anyway, I enlisted in April 1942, shortly after Pearl Harbor, and I was on inactive duty as an apprentice seaman until I graduated. Juniors and seniors in college could do that. So a few days after I graduated, I was off to midshipman school in a Notre Dame University. And when I finished there, I was commissioned as an ensign, so I was an officer in the Navy there. And then I had another great break where they sent me to Cornell University for marine engineering after that. And I was always been interested in engineering anyway, marine engineering. So that really gave me two tracks. And then we went and got a new ship called the LSMs. They were landing ships, had first ships to be built right off the drawing board without building a prototype. So we went to Texas, and I was assigned as chief engineer of the LSM-2, second one. Since I'd been interested in the merchant marine, I talked to guys in the merchant marines, merchant ships we saw, and eventually then I got licenses, first a third mate's license, and then later on a chief engineer's license in the merchant marine while I was still in the Navy. So we in the Navy, I made a couple of invasions, Leyte, when General MacArthur took over, returned to the Philippines. I was there not the D-Day, but shortly after. And right away, we saw merchant ships out in all those areas. And then I made the invasion of Okinawa, the last invasion of the war. And, of course, merchant ships were there, too, bringing in cargo. And, in fact, the nearest I came to being hurt in the Navy, you know, the Navy's great as long as you don't get hit. You have good food and a place to sleep. You don't roll around in the mud and all that stuff. But the nearest I came was at Okinawa after the invasion was made, and we were just landing cargo and troops and all that stuff. And the ship next to us, which was the French Victory, about 100 yards away, was hit by a kamikaze. We had kamikaze attacks every day and every day and every day, even though they had rings of destroyer, all kinds of ships and Air Force keeping them away. Always one or two got through every day. So I saw a merchant ship got blown up right there and probably killed everyone.
In Okinawa, you were involved in landing the troops and then bringing in supplies after they were on board the island?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and later we brought cargo from the States and landed that. And then we lightered ships from Navy cargo ships or merchant marine ships. We lightered the cargo ashore for them. And Okinawa, the same thing. We took an artillery battle group, eight 155-millimeter howitzers, and the crew to operate them. And we put them on the beach at Okinawa on D-Day, and they went off for the fighting. And then we spent the rest of the time lightering cargo. So the merchant marine ships were right there, and right in the battle. And as I said, that's the nearest I came was a merchant ship being hit next to me.
But a pretty important job landing the troops and bringing supplies in continually so they had all the food and ammunition and water they needed.
Well, yes, of course. It's an amazing amount of stuff you need, as anyone could figure out. And then my next assignment, well, we were in Ulithi staging for the invasion of Japan when the bomb was dropped. And so that was fine. Not only saved my life and a lot of Americans' lives, but it saved far more many Japanese lives, because they were training with pitchforks and wooden sticks to every man, woman, and child was going to fight.
So if we'd have had to invade, that would have been a bloody battle, wouldn't it?
That's right. It would have been bad. And not only for us, but for Japan, even worse. So then they sent us to Guadalcanal, and we loaded military surplus stuff and brought it back to the States. When we got back, they gave me a week, two or three weeks of leave. And then when I came back, I became a commanding officer of a rocket ship.
Okay, stop now right there.
Yeah.
What is a rocket ship?
Well, people...
Were you going to the moon, Marsh?
People wonder about that. In fact, we call it a rocket ship, but it should be a rocket firing ship, I guess you'd call it. But they were started with LSM hulls. That's why the number that was in the name of them. But then first they put a few fixed rockets on them, and some of them made the D-Day invasion in Normandy. And they were used at Iwo Jima and Okinawa and so forth. But then the sophisticated ones, I had the first one called the LSMR 401, and after that they're called the 401 class. And they had 20 spin-stabilized rockets and continuous firing, loading from underneath, and a 5-inch 38 gun. And we actually had the firepower of 6 Fletcher-class destroyers, or even a battleship. But a battleship could lay off 25 miles, deliver their stuff, and we had to go in within 2.5 miles. So we were made for supportive landing operations.
So this ship was the newest one in the Navy.
Yeah.
And you could stand a couple of miles offshore and continuously fire rockets to support the troops that were landing.
We could take 3 targets. We had a combat information center of a destroyer, gyro stabilized. So we could take 3 different targets pointing 3 different ways. We stay on them. The ship could roll and twist and turn, and they would all stay level. Kind of fun to watch that. So they were powerful ships for supporting invasions.
What a wonderful assignment.
Yeah, it was. I loved that. And I was only a Lieutenant JG. The billet was full lieutenant.
So because you understood above deck and below deck, they put you in charge and said, get out there and support our troops.
Yeah.
Let's get this done.
Yeah. About a year after the war, then they discharged me. And that ship went on to fight. It did a lot of fighting in the Korean War after I was on it. So I was ready for the Merchant Marine. At the moment, the Merchant Marine had promised not to go on strike during the war. And once the war was over, then he did go on strike. And they had a big, long one until that was settled. And then when that was over, then I went down and I got a master's license in Merchant Marine based on my experience as being captain of the rocket ship. So then I could go on any ship in the world.
Please stay with us. We'll be back with more from our Merchant Marine, Marsh Gabriel, in just a moment. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. Now we'll get back to our interview with Merchant Marine, Marsh Gabriel. Marsh, I want to talk to you about the Merchant Marine in World War II.
Yeah.
We couldn't have won World War II without the Merchant Marine.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Now, of course, in the Pacific, they were at the invasions and so forth. And they did... convoys, but the big convoys were going to Europe and Russia.
The North Atlantic convoys.
That's the merchant ships. And they would have, I don't know how many, you know, dozens or maybe a hundred of them in there, big convoys. And, of course, they were supported by Navy ships, destroyers and cruisers and so forth. But, of course, the German wolf packs were out after them with submarines. And so
big targets to take out the supplies.
So they would sink the merchant ships, and they wouldn't, rather than sink some little destroyer, they'd sink a merchant ship that had a whole cargo of tanks or airplanes or whatever, or oil tankers and so forth. So, as I said in the beginning, the merchant marine were targets. Wherever they were, anytime during the war, they were targets. Beyond that, those runs up to Murmansk and Archangel in Russia weren't fun. It was cold. It's clear up over the top of Norway and back down to Russia and ice and freezing cold and miserable work, plus being shot at or chased after by the German submarines. So they were very vital. So the point is, some people kind of wonder, but the merchant marine weren't military, but they were heroes and same as the military people. I mean, they were in the same danger, if not more danger. If you were in the merchant marine, you were on a ship and you were at sea and you had enemy subs or whatever looking after you and shooting at you all the time. So sounds like
going to war to me, Marsh.
Yeah. So they deserve to be considered heroes and combat veterans. Early on, nothing much was said about that. But then along in 1975, I think Congress passed a law saying that the World War II merchant mariners were combat veterans. And I don't know what they did about the GI Bill or that kind of thing, but the one point about them is, which a lot of people don't understand, they had good civilian pay on the merchant ships, whereas the Navy, military, Army, and all those guys were, you know, small pay. They were sawing $30 a day once a month. But the military then took care of them after the war. We had the GI Bill. I did graduate study at three universities, America and Europe, on the GI Bill and so forth. And the merchant marine didn't. You know, they had their job and that was it. So I don't know if they got that help later on.
So, Marsh, when we think about World War II in Europe and the Pacific,
yeah,
those merchant marine vessels, those ships were the supply line, the critical supply line mm-hmm. to bring everything we needed to pursue the war in Europe and the Pacific. And without them,
yes,
we couldn't have won.
No, that's absolutely right. The Navy had some AKAs. Those are amphibious cargo ships. They didn't land. They were merchant ships, C-2s and so forth. I sailed on one after the war, C-2 freighters. They were designed they were with the amphibious forces. They didn't go on a beach. But all the other stuff was merchant ships carried out. Merchant ships carry them all over. And so, of course, they were just as vital as anything else. You can't operate without ammunition and food and everything else you need. So they were vital, and they were all over both oceans and even other places, the Indian Ocean and so forth, you know, getting rubber or whatever.
And those merchant mariners knew they had a target on their back, and they went out to sea anyway to deliver those vital supplies.
That's right. They were great guys, and they ships were sunk, of course, all over the place they were sunk. And if you're on a tanker, you go down, and you're swimming around in thick, heavy oil and so forth. So
dangerous jobs, but those men showed up every day and did their job and helped us win the war.
Yeah, that's right. Sure. They were heroes just like the military, and like the military who were in the battle zones.
So, Marsh, after you got out of the Navy and you joined the Merchant Marine in 1946?
47.
How long did you stay in, and what did you do?
Well, I wanted to see the world. I didn't want to have a career in the Merchant Marine. I wanted to see the world, and I did. So I sailed as third mate on different ships every cruise. I sailed on five ships all over the world. My first one, I remember quite well, coming out of Chesapeake Bay, crossing the bar. We came and she went down and lifted up over the bar and down, and I was off to see the world on merchant ships, and that's what I did. And so it was good pay too, and working all the time. And one thing about merchant ships, this has nothing to do with wartime, but they're part of the local scene. If you're a tourist and you go around and look at what's going on, Well, it's like trucks hauling from Chicago to St. Louis. They're part of the local scene, and the merchant ships are part of the local scene. So it's not like cruise ships where you land 1,000 people on the shore and they go out to whatever. They were part of the local scene all over the world. And I made 2 trips around the world. My first one was to Italy, then I came back to New Orleans, signed on another one, a Victory ship, going down to Rio and Santos, Brazil, and a great time there. And incidentally, in Santos, I saved the life of a girl who was drowning, and they brought her in on a raft. I gave her artificial respiration, which I'd learned in the Boy Scouts. That was my life as a young boy. And she's alive today, unless she's died of old age because of that. And then I signed on a ship. I thought it was going to go to L.A. We were in New York. I sailed on that one, and we ended up, that was a Victory. Well, that's a Lane Victory, which I showed you a picture of it. It's the now the museum ship in Los Angeles Harbor. So we were heading through the canal, and they said go down to Tocopilla, Chile, and load nitrate for Egypt, and we did that. And they sent us Sardinia and loaded salt for Japan, and we did that, bunkered at Singapore, and then Hawaii for scrap iron and back to the States. So that's called a tramp voyage.
So, Marsh, somewhere during all of this vast experience and being at sea and on the ocean, you took time out to get married and have a family.
Yeah, well, after my time in the Navy and the Merchant Marine, then I went back to school with a GI Bill and to get a master's here in University of Minnesota. And my first day here, I met a girl that interviewed about housing, and the interview went for 3 hours, and I went home and wrote my parents, I just met the girl today I'm going to marry. It wasn't love at first sight. It was an hour and a half before I decided I was going to marry her. And we were married for 64 years. She died a year ago. Wonderful marriage, 64 years. So we studied in Europe and traveled and camped all over. And then I'd always had the dream of sailing around the world on a boat. When I got a family, same thing. So I went back.
Oh, you had several children in between here, right?
Well, yeah. We had 6 children.
You went back to sea after you had the children?
Yes. Yeah, we came back here, and but then I still wanted to take the family and sail around the world. And the only way I could figure to do it was to go back to sea and get a ship and then do that. So I sailed first in a sailing research ship for Stanford University, and then I went to Windjammer Cruise Ships, and I was captain of every one of their ships from the 1960s on, except the last one. Eventually, I bought my own ship. I went to Sweden and bought a ship, and I couldn't afford a yacht, so I got a sailing cargo ship, a 380-ton cargo ship, and that was our income for 12 years. And so we took the family on. I traded a year in Europe and then back to the West Indies, my oldest son and his wife worked on it in Europe, and then in the West Indies, the family came on for cruises, and the kids worked on it and so forth. They grew up and got married and all that, so we never did make the round the world trip. But I introduced them to the world, which was what I wanted.
Do they love the sea as much as you?
Oh yeah. My wife too. She loves the sea. Yeah.
Well, you certainly were lucky to find your wife.
Well, you can believe that. She's a very wonderful person, independent of anything like that, and a great strong Christian, and loves everybody, almost everybody, and. Meets everybody, talking, traveling. She talked to the local people, whatever their language. If she forget the Spanish words, she'd go to French. If she forget the German words, she'd go to Swedish. And she has just a wonderful life and wonderful family. And the family all, because of my life, have become adventurers, and they've all traveled around the world, too.
She went along with you on all those adventures.
Yeah, she did. She did. She's tough. She'd take care of the 5 kids at home still left and her aging mother at one time. But she loved the sea, and we introduced all of our kids to the world. She'd lived and studied in Europe for a year and a half before we met. So it was just a great life.
Marsh, we're just about out of time. Any last thoughts for our listeners about the Merchant Marine?
The Merchant Marine, in the thing you read when we started, it said 450 ships. Right after World War II, we undoubtedly had far more ships than that. Because in the war, a lot of ships were sunk. We were building them and giving them to other people and so forth and so on. They sailed all over the world, and that's why I could sail all over. You know, I want to go to South Africa, okay. East Africa, okay. I would just get on a ship and go and get paid. I mean, I saved up money to buy my newspaper with all of that and getting paid. So they're vital. And because it costs so much, it costs 5 times as much to build a ship in America as it does in Korea or China. And when we say merchant marine, we usually think of the big cargo ships and passenger ships. But But that article was quite accurate. There's a lot of confusion about them. They're not military. It's not an organization. It's just an occupation.
And looking back, you enjoyed your time in the United States Navy and the Merchant Marine.
Yes, yeah, that was great.
Marsh, I want to thank you for joining us today on Minnesota Military Radio.
Well, you're welcome. It's been fun.
That was Marsh Gabriel, a veteran of the United States Navy in World War II and the Merchant Marine on Minnesota Military Radio. Today's Yellow Ribbon Company Spotlight is Super America Northern Tier Energy. Known throughout Minnesota as Super America, Northern Tier Energy is owned by Western Refinery and has over 240 corporate and franchise locations across the United States. At all of their locations, they have a focus on hiring skilled veteran leaders and take pride in showing a visible sign of support to those who have served our country. They have focused efforts on identifying all military employees and military family members in their organization and have developed internal procedures to show their appreciation and support. Super America Northern Tier Energy has been a Yellow Ribbon company since July of 2014 and is honored and proud to be making a difference to service members, veterans, and their families. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a moment, we're going to meet Minnesota's Secretary of State, Steve Simon. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, here's Commissioner Larry Shelleteau.
The gold star symbolizes the loss of a loved one while serving in the armed forces of the United States, whether it be in combat or duty other than combat. Gold Star families have given so much and continue to give back to the community through voluntary acts. In bearing the loss of a loved one, Gold Star mothers, fathers, spouses, and their families truly understand the cost of this country's security and freedom. The family members of our fallen have earned the utmost respect and undying gratitude of our nation and our state.
Thank you, Commissioner Shelleteau. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Steve Simon is Minnesota's 22nd Secretary of State. He was sworn into office on January 5, 2015. As Minnesota's Chief Elections Administrator, he pledged in his inaugural address to work with anyone of any political affiliation from any part of our state to protect, defend, and strengthen the right to vote in Minnesota. Mr. Simon, Secretary of State Simon, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thanks a lot for having me. Good to be here.
Sir, that sounded like a pretty good speech you gave when you first took office. Apparently, you don't care whether they're Republican, Democrat, or otherwise. Man, woman, you work with everybody, and we want everybody to have a good chance to vote.
Don't care at all. To me, it's all about democracy. It's all about making sure people have access to the right to vote if they're eligible to vote. And my work ends there. I'm not concerned with how people vote. I just want to make sure people have that opportunity. And if they choose to, that it's easy for them to do it.
Sir, can you share with us? I'm sure everybody in Minnesota usually knows that Secretary of State takes care of the voting and it's coming up on voting season, but you've got a lot of other duties over there too.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say kind of the signature duty that most people associate with the office, if they think about the office, is the voting stuff. That's when the spotlight tends to find the office, not the other way around. But we do other stuff too. For example, a majority of our workforce in the office is not with elections. It's with the business services section. These are the folks that help us process a lot of different kinds of commercial documents. Virtually every business in Minnesota, big and small, has to file stuff with our office, both originally when they go into business and then thereafter, usually annually. And so we process that and a bunch of other commercial documents. We also run something that I'm really proud of called the Safe at Home program. Safe at Home is an address confidentiality program for victims of domestic violence, stalking, sexual assault. Basically allows people in the program to keep their true physical address confidential and secret so that no one can find them who they don't want to find them. And so we, for example, handle their mail, whether it's the cable bill or a personal letter. We get that to them so no one truly knows where they physically live. It's a lifesaver, something we're real proud of. So those are some examples of some of the things we do. But of course, it's election season. Most people think about the elections function.
Sir, as you said, it's election season, and it's been an exciting year. The national presidential election is coming up, and there's a lot of talk about that. But there's also a lot of local officials up for re-election this year as well.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, the presidential election tends to suck a lot of the oxygen out of the room, of course. But let's not forget, there are every 2 years, there's always a vote for U.S. Congress, no matter where you live. The Minnesota House of Representatives, this year, the state Senate is up. And depending on where you live, county commissioners, local races, if folks don't know what's on their ballot, where they live, they can go to mnvotes.org. That's our website, mnvotes.org. They can type in their address, and you can click on a feature that gives you a sample ballot of where you live, so you know who the county commissioner candidates are or the state legislature candidates. And there are even links there to their websites, if they have a website, so you can figure out what they're saying about themselves in their own words.
Now, Mr. Secretary, when we have a national election, a presidential election, it usually brings out more voters. But also here in Minnesota, we weren't quite known for having a good voter turnout.
Absolutely. I mean, this is where we can really brag as a state. For 9 elections in a row, Minnesota was number one in the country in voter turnout. That is a mind-blowing win streak, I would say, in any context. So 9 in a row, we were number one. We fell off a bit in 2014. We went from number one to number 6, still very decent, still respectable, but not quite up to our usual Minnesota standards. So my goal this year has been to challenge all of us in Minnesota to get back to number one. We owned that spot for a long time. I think we know what it takes, and I think we can get there this year if we work hard at it. I think we've got a presidential election going on, frankly, which is conducive to that. And I say that just because, you know, you've got 2 major party candidates, for example, that inspire very strong feelings. Doesn't matter where you sit or stand politically. I think people just feel strongly about these 2 people, whether it's strong like or strong dislike. And I only mention that because that kind of intensity tends to drive turnout. If people feel strongly about the candidates, whether that's strong like or strong dislike, they're probably going to show up. I think they will this year again.
We're speaking with Minnesota's Secretary of State Steve Simon on Minnesota Military Radio. Mr. Secretary, as you probably well know, since September 11, 2001, we've had a lot of Minnesotans deployed overseas as part of the Guard and Reserve and some active duty folks. And can you tell us what's the process for them to fill out absentee ballots?
Absolutely. And this is something, thank you for giving me the chance to emphasize it. There's a special category for people who are in our military. Active duty, whether they're overseas or not. If they're away from their home in Minnesota, they get special privileges and shortcuts. So anyone in that category can go to our website. It's mnvotes.org, and they can order that absentee ballot, have it sent to them, and wherever they are in the world, doesn't matter. And this applies, by the way, to folks in the military. It could be students studying abroad as well. It could be diplomats, business people. In that special category, you get it automatically sent to you. And here's one of the shortcuts. If you fall into this category, you don't have to have a witness like the rest of us do on your absentee ballot. So you can just send it in by yourself. It'll come to you. You send it back by any way that you can. I suppose you could do UPS, but regular mail. Military mail service, as long as it gets back by election day. And that's the key thing. Sometimes there's some confusion. Can't be postmarked by election day. It's got to get back by election day. If you do that, you're in good shape. And we want everyone to have that opportunity to register and vote.
So for our deployed service members, they go to minnesotavotes.org and they can get a ballot, download it, print it out, and then they have to mail it back into the state.
That's it.
Are those ballots available already?
Yes, they're available right now. They've been available for quite some time. And so as of this broadcast, they are available. We were in the thick of that absentee ballot season. So from here on out, that's all fair game. I urge folks to get that ballot, get it printed out, get it sent back as soon as you can. And I just have to put a fine point on one thing. Every year, for as far back as I can think of, unfortunately, there's some ballots that come in late. Folks who either were confused about the deadline being election day for arrival or for whatever reason. So I really urge anyone listening to either themselves or to those that they know who are wearing the uniform to get it in as soon as you can so you don't end up being one of those non-counted ballots that unfortunately comes in Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or afterwards. We got to get the military vote to count.
So once again, for our deployed military members, or even if they're here, go to minnesotavotes.org. Download that ballot and get it in before Election Day. Now, is there early voting for the rest of the population, too?
Absolutely. We in Minnesota have what's now called no excuses absentee voting, which basically means you don't have to be absent anymore to vote absentee. It means any one of us can just do it because we want to do it. You go to mnvotes.org. You can order that absentee ballot to come to your home. You can vote from your couch or kitchen table if you want, or you can do it the old-fashioned way, which is to go to a government office, usually a city hall or a county office, and vote in-person absentee. But we're right in the thick of that absentee ballot period. Anytime between now and the day before Election Day, you can either go in or have a ballot sent to you, vote from your couch or kitchen table. I think more and more people are kind of embracing that new way of voting.
Now, Mr. Secretary, for those service members that are deployed, if they go to MinnesotaVotes.org, is there some information on the folks that are running for office as well?
Yes, absolutely. If you go, and anyone might be in this situation, you might not exactly be keeping up with it, who's on the ballot and what's on the ballot. If you go to MNVotes.org, you can click on a feature called My Ballot, and you put in some address information or other information. It'll walk you through that. And then up comes a sample ballot that will say who's running for what in your particular area. It even has links to information about the candidates in their own words. It's a really good resource for people who might know about the presidential race, but maybe not the rest of it.
Thank you, sir. We have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been speaking with Minnesota's Secretary of State, Steve Simon, about absentee voting and about the big election coming up. It's a presidential election, and it also includes Congress and a lot of local elections. And is it a big ballot this year?
You know, not as big as you'd think, because we don't have a governor's race or U.S. Senate or any of the statewide offices, so it's a little probably shorter. But that just means people can focus more. And, of course, the presidency takes up a lot of the kind of discussion and attention.
And Mr. Secretary, we talked earlier about your other duties, which also include if anybody's opening a business of any kind and want to file for an entity, whether it's a C corporation, an S corporation, a limited liability, they do that through your office. And there's standard forms and things they have to file to get registered and get the name they want and those type of things. But I understand that you've developed something called the Minnesota Business Snapshot that is going to voluntarily collect some other information.
Yeah, and this all grew out of a conversation that I had with a representative of a veteran service organization right after I was elected. And he said, hey, why is it that a veteran-owned business can't check a box or make themselves known somehow right when they file their business status? Why can't they do that? And I said, I don't know, I'll find out. And the answer is, other than just the time, effort, and elbow grease to do it, there is no barrier. So we've decided to do that. So we're going to be asking people to fill out a survey, totally voluntary, no one has to do it. 5 questions only, short and sweet, take you a couple minutes. When you renew your business information every year, and one of the questions, in fact, the lead question will be, are you a veteran-owned business, and then other categories as well. Are you woman-owned, disability-owned, minority-owned? And then some other questions as well, totally voluntary, that people can use to flesh out who they are. And this information will help not only other businesses, it will help consumers, it will help journalists, it will help academics. It's just kind of deepening the pool of information all voluntarily collected out there about what and who our Minnesota businesses are.
So for our listeners out there, some of you that own businesses understand this, but for those of you that don't, when you first form a business, you sit down with your attorney, you choose an entity type, a taxation type, they file some information with the Secretary of State's office, and they also at that time check to see if your name is already taken or not so that you can use a unique name. And then every year thereafter, you go online and you file another form saying, yes, I'm still active, I'm still here. So this new form, the Minnesota Business Snapshot, is 5 questions that will be asked initially and also be asked when you file that renewal each year?
That's right.
And as you say, there's 5 questions that has to do with the size of the business, some choices like veteran or a member of a disability community, member of an immigrant community, NAISCS code, but
yes,
that's just the code that says what type of business
you're
in.
Yeah, exactly.
Full-time employees and what kind of size the business is. But the one thing that I'm interested in is veteran-owned businesses, because we've been looking for years for other veteran-owned businesses, and it's hard to find them. So once you've done this for a year or two or three, if I need to find some other veteran-owned businesses, will I be able to come to you and get that information?
Yes, you will. And any citizen in Minnesota can do that, too. You can either call. You'll be able to order it online. The point is, we want to make that information available, provide value to businesses, but provide value to consumers as well. There are some of your listeners, I'm sure, or others out there who might say, you know, all things being equal, I want to give my money to veteran-owned businesses. So now they'll have a place to go to find out who those folks are. I think that's a good thing.
I think this is going to be great. I'm getting excited about it. And there's some other organizations such as Trust Vets and some others out there that do this. So soon, with the help of the Minnesota Business Snapshot and the Secretary of State's office, we'll be able to connect veteran business owners with the folks that want to find them. That's great work, sir. We just got a couple of minutes left. I think we should go back to absentee balloting one more time.
Yes.
And tell both our deployed service members and anybody else how to go about that, sir.
Right. Well, if you're a deployed service member, it's very easy. You go to mnvotes.org. That's our website, mnvotes.org. And if you fall under that category, you are eligible to have your ballot sent to you either by mail or by fax or email. That's something that the rest of us who are not active duty do not get to have. So you can have your ballot actually sent to you by fax or email. You can't send it back that way. We don't have that in law yet. You have to send it back the old-fashioned way by mail. But the key thing to remember is when you get that absentee ballot, fill it out. You don't need a witness. That's another shortcut that our military folks get that the rest of us don't, and it's well-deserved. And then remember to send it back early. You know, the recommendation is if you can, send it back about a month early. Send it back instead of November 8th, the day of the election, October 8th or thereabouts. Why? Because the rule is it's got to get in by election day, not postmarked. It's got to get in there. And you don't want your ballot to be part of that sad pile of ballots, which we sometimes get from everyone that come in after election day. Got to get there by election day. Sign up, be a voter, get that absentee ballot. You can print it out, send it in, and then your vote will be counted.
So if a member of your family is deployed, send them a note, send them an email, send them a text, tell them to go to minnesotavotes.org. They can get their absentee ballot. And if they go to that same website, they can go in there and they can hit on My Ballot, and they can see what the ballot's going to look like, and they can find some information about who's running for office so that they can get up to speed on that. But do it quick and get it in the mail as soon as possible.
Amen.
And for the rest of us, if we want to vote early, what's the process for that? We got about 30 seconds.
Same deal. You go to mnvotes.org. You can order an absentee ballot to your home. It'll come by mail to your home. You can vote from your couch or kitchen table on your own schedule. Just make sure it gets back there by election day. You can hand deliver it or mail it. It's just got to get back by election day. That's increasingly the way to go. A lot of freedom, a lot of flexibility. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way, like I still like to do. Go to the polling place November 8th.
Very good, sir. And that's minnesotavotes.org. Thanks for joining us today on Minnesota Military Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
That was Minnesota's Secretary of State, Steve Simon, on Minnesota Military Radio. Joining me now is the President of the Navy League Minnesota, Brian Scon. Brian, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be back. I appreciate the invite.
Brian, I understand we've got two new sailors in your family.
Yeah, I'm putting my money where my mouth is. My oldest, who's 23, his name's Cameron, just graduated from Navy boot camp at Naval Station Great Lakes on August 12th. He's heading to USS John C. Stennis, CVN 74, a carrier that's based in Bremerton. My daughter did the delayed entry in her senior year in high school. She just turned 19. She graduated September 16th. She's heading to an East Coast carrier, USS Harry S. Truman, CVN 75. So the Navy, love the Navy. They put my kids in opposite coasts.
And you've got a couple more ships to watch besides the ones that that you support as president of the Navy League Minnesota.
That's right. Well, USS Minnesota, our fast attack submarine, just did a two-month underway and got back this week. And we believe Commander Tanaka will be back in Minnesota for our Navy ball in a couple of weeks.
Well, we'd love to.
Jessica.
We'd love to catch up with him if we get a chance. Now, Minnesota was delayed in going out to sea. They had a little trouble. Is everything in order now?
Yeah, I have gotten communication that that whatever the issue was has been resolved, and she is being put through her paces for in preparation for a 2017 deployment.
So next year she'll be out there guarding the United States of America all over the world.
She will, yeah. And we'll never know where she is, and that's by design.
Well, it's quite a boat. We were out there, as you know, at the commissioning and got a tour of it. And the Secretary of Navy says that we own the oceans. And after seeing the USS Minnesota, I believe him.
Yeah, absolutely. I truly believe that with China building their fake islands, they're not very happy when we send surface ships through on freedom of navigation exercises. But I think their biggest fear is our fast attack submarines. They are literally light years ahead of anywhere else.
I'm glad we've got them out there. Brian, I want to touch next. You've got this U.S. Navy birthday ball coming up October 15th at the Marriott Northwest in Brooklyn Park.
Yes, we do. We do this annually. We do this every year, typically in the middle of October. The actual Navy's birthday is October 13th. And so we try to get as close as possible for the Saturday, either before or after. And our website's NavyBallMN.org. Again, NavyBallMN.org. And we'd welcome participation from our Navy enthusiasts and our Navy veterans, and even veterans from other branches as well.
So that's open to anybody that'd like to go.
Sure. And it's easy to register, again, at NavyBallMN.org.
Brian, we just got a couple of minutes left, but I understand that we've got a new ship under construction, LCS-21, that's going to be called the USS Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Yeah, pretty excited about that. The Navy League, my organization, lobbied the Secretary of the Navy in 2015 for an additional ship. She is a littoral combat ship, littoral means near shore. She is of the Freedom class. There are two classes. The Freedom class is a monohull. The Independence class is a trimaran. And what's interesting about our Freedom class, she's actually built at Marionette Marine, just 40 minutes north of Green Bay, Wisconsin, on Lake Michigan. And I did just get a general construction schedule. Her keel authentication ceremony will be in June of 2017. She will be launched 10 months later, and she will be commissioned in mid-2019. So we're about two and a half years out.
Brian, I think we'll have to stay in touch with that one. We may have to travel to northern Wisconsin to do a show.
Absolutely. Pretty exciting to get another ship. And part of the reason they gave us that ship is because of our performance in commissioning USS Minnesota. So we're well thought of by the Navy. What's also exciting is the Navy is going to bring back the Blue Angels to the Duluth Air Show June 3rd and 4th of next year. So we've got a lot of Navy presence, a lot of Navy activities that are happening. The Navy likes our support.
So for our listeners out there, please check out Navy League Minnesota. Brian hasn't told you, but he's the president of the commissioning committee for the USS Minneapolis-St. Paul, and they're raising funds for that big celebration when that ship is commissioned. And, Brian, we just got about 30 seconds left. You have your annual U.S. Navy birthday ball coming up October 15th, 2016, at the Marriott Northwest Brooklyn Park. Information available at NavyBallMN.org.
Brian,
did I miss anything, Brian?
You nailed it, Tom, and I appreciate you getting me on again. Thank you so much.
Well, I look forward to having you on the show very soon, and take care, and let's stay in touch.
I appreciate that. Roger that.
Thank you. That was Brian Skahn, the president of the Navy League Minnesota. We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Marsh Gabriel, Secretary of State Steve Simon, Brian Skahn from Navy League Minnesota, Commissioner Larry Shelado of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we talk about the Minnesota National Guard's Junior Diversity Council and our Gold Star families. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
Minnesota Military Radio is a production of iHeartMedia, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minneapolis VA, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and the Minnesota National Guard. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phelan Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is a life member of the American Legion, VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and the DAV. For podcasts and the latest updates, follow us at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.